WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and director John Waters built a cult following through his talent to shock and amuse. His repertory company of actors spotlighted people whose looks were considered social liabilities, but through exaggeration and caricature were turned into style. This was especially true of Divine, the 300-pound man who starred as a woman in such Waters films as Pink Flamingos, Polyester, and Hairspray. Hairspray was the movie that brought Waters mainstream success. His new movie, Crybaby, has an even bigger budget. Crybaby pays homage to the rock and roll teen exploitation films of the 50s. Squares and hoods face off and sing and dance. Johnny Depp of TV's 21 Jump Street is the leader of the hoods. Troy Donahue, Patty Hearst, Joey Heatherton, and Iggy Pop have cameos. This is from the movie's big prison production number after Johnny Depp is put behind bars.
Cut these shackles off of me.
Let me go, let me go.
This kind of suit don't set me free.
Set me free, set me free.
Well, I can't live if I can't ride.
Let me ride, let me ride.
I want a baby by my side.
I want my baby by my side.
Just stop for a little fun, but I'm guilty till I'm 21. Guess I'm doing time.
Why did you want to do another teen film?
I wanted to do a musical, the kind where people break into song for no apparent reason, which
right.
I had never, ever done. A real early 50s musical. And it seems to me that they're always about teenagers, and the fact that I liked working with kids so much in Hairspray that it just seemed to me to be, I don't know, something I was comfortable with.
Yeah, it strikes me you're in the middle of this real perverse version of, you know, when I was young, we had good clean movies, and you're taking all these, like, young actors and saying, when I was young, we watched juvenile delinquent films.
Yeah, but it's so, today a juvenile delinquent is such a nice word, actually.
Yes, that's
it's
right.
A sexy word. I mean, so what I wanted to do was sort of in the spirit of Reefer Madness or those kind of movies, go back and make the most shocking move 1954 movie I could make, and I think that would be a comedy today. This movie couldn't have been shown in 1954.
Is it making you feel old at all to be casting teen stars and teaching them about the old days of juvenile delinquency?
Well, I like feeling old, so it doesn't bother me. The older I get, I think the happier I am. So that doesn't bother me. I think it's funny, certainly, that they don't remember any of this. But, you know, this took place in 54. I was only 8. I don't remember it all. I went to the library for a month and did research before I wrote this. So it's almost a historical movie to myself also.
1954 was a really scary year on the pop charts. You know, you had Perry Como doing Papa Loves
Square
Mambo.
Music,
yeah.
Right. That's what this is about, square music and drape music. And the square music was played on Your Hit Parade on television, and the top 10 was that, and all the squares listened to that. But the drapes, which was a Baltimore word, and some Philadelphia, I hear, were the hoods. And they listened to music that was generally black, and it was it sold millions of copies, but it was never played on the radio. It was only played on jukeboxes. Sort of a little bit like what rap is today.
Yeah, you use the word drapes for hoods. In Brooklyn, we used to call the hoods hitters.
Oh, that's a new one.
Is it new to you?
Yeah, well, because Greasers is sort of wrong, because Greasers is after rock and roll, and this movie takes place before rock and roll. So drapes were sort of in between Zoot Suits and Greasers. In between there was when drapes were. Johnny Ray was the first drape and crybaby that I remember.
So the movie set in 1954. You were 8 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
Were you watching teen movies at that time?
No. Well, my parents would have never taken me to those movies. No.
Yeah.
I had heard about The Wild One. All the real juvenile delinquent movies I saw much later in life, actually right before I wrote this movie. I remembered Girls Town, where Paul Anka sings Mamie Van Doren, the Ave Maria. I could never erase that from my mind. But that was the only one I remember. But I read a lot. I had a lot of books that had about them. And certainly you've seen those posters for years, like Drag Strip Girl,
yeah,
and The Violent Years and all that stuff. So I thought that I wanted to make one in reverse, where the bad guys are the good guys and the good guys are the bad guys.
So when you went back and screened a lot of these old teen exploitation films,
mm-hmm,
Which stood out to you as being the most interesting?
Well, they were all pretty terrible, actually. That was the weird thing, but you could take little pieces from... my favorite is certainly The Girl Can't Help It, which is more of a musical. High School Confidential was certainly good. There was one, and I forget it, where this unwed mother had this girl where she'd come home. It was so pitiful. This, and I forget what it was called. Maybe Teenage Doll it was called, I think. It was. And that one had some funny unwed mother stuff in it, which I certainly sort of influenced Ricky Lake's character in this.
Yeah.
But in when I was 8, I couldn't be a drape. My parents wouldn't let me. I was still a square.
So when you were old enough to act on it, were you too old to really care?
The problem was I always had thin hair, and it's hard to be a drape with thin hair. But at the same time, also, would have never been very good in gang fights. So as always, I watched. You know, I've always, that's what filmmakers always do. They watch.
The voyeur watching all the other,
yes,
all the
but
other drapes.
They knew, and there was a drapette in my neighborhood, too, and I used to watch her bullet bra every day at the bus stop.
Did you have your actresses wear those?
Oh, yes. We have lots of bullet bras in this movie. Definitely. Tracy Lords actually stabbed someone with her breast in it, which you could have done with these bras in the 50s.
I remember when I interviewed Mamie Van Doren, and she said that they made her take one home so it would look like she looked this way all the time.
Right. And then they look like so uncomfortable. I mean, and, you know, Fredericks of Hollywood, I think, thought them up. And they have a bra museum. And they have a great one in the bra museum.
You've been there, no doubt.
Yes, I have been there, yeah. I think it travels even. It may come to, you know, a mall near you if you're lucky.
You've called this your first boy movie. What's the difference between a girl movie and a boy movie?
Well, my other one starred a boy, Divine, but he usually played a girl. That's the difference. It's the first movie I've had a male lead in it. Now, I think Johnny Depp and Divine, in some ways, I would never ever try to replace Divine. But in some ways, they are the same. They're both good actors, and they're both movie stars. They were just different ends of the spectrum.
How did you cast Johnny Depp in the lead?
I cast him because I never even considered anybody else. When I was writing the movie, I thought, who's going to play this? God, I mean, I don't have anybody in my repertory group offhand. I can't think of anybody. So I bought all the teen magazines, which is really an embarrassing thing to do when you're 43 years old and you're by yourself in Provincetown. And, you know, $30 worth of them. Like, I'll have Bump and Tutti Frutti and... And he was in all of them, and he hates being in them, which I always kid him about it because that's how I found out about him. And he looked exactly like Crybaby. That was the first step. And all the other ones looked horrible to me. They were in these magazines. So I called him, and he was really funny on the phone. He liked my old movies, which is I usually try to discourage actors if they don't know my earlier work from looking at it right before we shoot because I figure it'll make them nervous and they might not do it. So, but he said he'd like Pink Flamingos and everything, and I could just tell that he had a sense of humor about himself, and he wanted to make fun of his own image, which, when you agree to do a John Waters movie, that's almost in the contract.
Yeah, well, I figure, you know, someone has to be on your wavelength to make the movie. They have to have, like, a sense of humor. So you usually feel them out talking to them beforehand?
Yeah, I definitely do. And there's certainly a lot of names that you would think would be in a John Waters movie of people that I didn't hire. I'll never tell you who because it's not fair to the people who play the parts. But not everybody. I mean, and they all read for me. Patty Hearst read for me.
She was great, by the way.
Thanks,
she gave one of my favorite performances in the movie. She's so in the spirit of it.
She is. And I think, why not have some fun with being Patty Hearst for the first time? I mean, all that other stuff certainly wasn't fun for her. It was a big ordeal. So she didn't ask to be famous. She is famous, whether she likes it or not, for the rest of her life. So why not, for once, have fun? I mean, there's a paper in New York called Paper, and she's on the cover. And I love it because she's on the cover for being a movie actress.
Well, did you have to feel her out to see if she could be on the right wavelength for the movie?
Well, I knew that because I met her at the Cannes Film Festival, and there was something about her. We just instantly kind of got along, and it was peculiar because I had just seen the Patty Hearst movie, which I liked very, very much, and I told her that it had made me believe that she was innocent for the first time, which I guess is not the best, you know, some people might not, wouldn't have been the best opening line in a friendship. And she had a sense of humor.
You have a big prison musical number in Crybaby, and I was wondering if you screened Jailhouse Rock for Johnny Depp, or if you already knew the movie.
I think he probably already knew it. I think the stuff I screened, Johnny did watch a lot of Elvis movies, but also all the juvenile delinquent movies I got, and Amy Locane, who's the female lead, I made her watch a lot of Anne Margaret movies, and because
right.
Anne is, I mean, there is a scene, if you've ever seen Viva Las Vegas, where Anne Margaret has a glamour fit, where she... You think she's going to spontaneously combust from glamour. It is the most glamorous scene. She goes insane from glamour, and I showed Amy that a lot. Rent It Out, Wilson. Just get to that scene when she comes out and sings Viva Las Vegas. It's amazing.
This is your first movie without Divine. Was the movie conceived when he was still alive?
No, it's also not the first movie. Desperate Living, Divine was not in.
Okay.
No, it was completely written after Divine had passed away. So I had no way. I would never replace him. I would never use a man playing a woman. I was so paranoid, actually, that anybody would think I was trying to replace him with any part, that I don't really think you'll see any part in this that Divine would have or could have played, because the very fact I knew he couldn't. If Divine had been alive, certainly he would have been in Crybaby, and it would be a different script, and I don't know in what way, because I never wrote it that way.
Had his health been okay before he died?
As much as it can be for if you're very overweight. He always had had a sleeping disorder. It was impossible to even sleep in his apartment because of the amount of noise he made from just gasping for breath. So it was always scary to hear him sleep. It certainly was a shock that he died, but how he died was not surprising to anybody that knew him. And I think certainly, you know, when Johnny came to town, in a very unghoulish way, we went to the cemetery because we go there a lot, and it was around Christmas, and we bring donuts and Christmas trees and everything to the grave. So it was sort of a symbolic thing in a way, this passing of this some whatever it is. And the first day when I looked through the camera and saw Johnny, the first take was Johnny driving up on a motorcycle. And I said, well, it is a boy movie for the first time. But Johnny and Divine would have liked each other very, very, very much. And to me, they're both good actors and movie stars, and that was it.
Divine's funeral was in Baltimore, right?
Right.
I assume it was organized by his family.
It was. It was organized, unfortunately, by his family and our press agents, because it happened right after Hairspray had opened. So, Divine would have liked it. Divine would have liked to have leapt from his coffin and done the twist on the top of it. It was a media event of sorts, only because of the story that, well, because he died, period. But it was handled well. But his all our friends were there, and all his family was there, and it was very nice. His family was very, very gracious.
Was there a lot of odd discussion between family and press agent and friends about how to dress?
Oh,
his
no, because Divine never ever dressed as a woman.
No, I don't mean to dress as a woman, but to dress in a tux or to dress.
Oh, he looked like Alfred Hitchcock.
He'd wear.
He looked like Alfred Hitchcock. It was a open casket, which wouldn't have been my choice, but. I find that scary, but obviously they didn't. And he looked good. He looked like Alfred Hitchcock. He had his big diamond stud earring on and a black tie.
Did you have a separate ceremony of just friends afterwards?
Oh, no. Well, we had a big wake afterwards, yes.
Uh-huh.
But no, because it was a great funeral, actually. It was, and the reverend that spoke was wonderful. You know, he knew Divine as a little boy, and he was very, very good. He said, frankly, we didn't know what to do. And later, the reverend told me a good story that after the New Yorker wrote up Divine's funeral, and there was all these evangelists called this preacher, not a preacher, this reverend, and said, how could you bury Divine? You know what he did at the end of Pink Flamingos? And the reverend said, well, theologically, it's certainly not a sin to eat dog do, which I thought was great and a very, you know, what religious people should say.
No, I read that you gave up smoking.
Yes, I'm embarrassed to be a non-smoker. I hate non-smokers. I could never love a non-smoker. And, but yes, I did.
I was wondering if that had anything to do with Divine's death, you know, with this, maybe new sense of mortality.
I think there were two reasons. The main reasons is, one, I had a horrible cough that sounded frightening, and the day I stopped, I never coughed again. And secondly, my brother had a brain tumor. My brother is fine now. They did an operation. Everything's fine. But that, even though it has nothing to do with smoking, that mortality thing, I think, is what pushed me over. And also, I quit smoking in the most ludicrous way in the Beverly Hills smoking clinic, where they give you these shots full of drugs behind your ears. And it made me completely insane. I would never advise anybody to quit smoking.
What made you enter a clinic-type situation?
Because people I knew, Robert Downey, had told me that it worked. And all these people that were militant smokers told that it worked for them. And I've later showed the brochures and what was in these shots to many doctors who said it has nothing to do with smoking. However, it worked for me. But I could, if I smoked one cigarette, I'd smoke 2,000 of them tomorrow to make up for the 6 months that I haven't smoked.
Do you have dreams where you smoke a cigarette and you figure, I'm hooked again?
Yes, that's frightening in the beginning. You certainly do that. But there's nothing more boring than listening to addicts talk about their old drugs.
The Johnny Depp character in Crybaby mm-hmm. has one tear that streams down his eye. That's his kind of trademark. You could never get him to cry, but it has one tier.
Right.
How did you come up with that conceit?
I don't know. Just like cheesy symbolism. And the idea of a tough guy doing, and I don't know. And Crybaby, the song, was the first 45 I ever bought as a child when I was about 8 years old. And so that I liked the name. I thought it was a sexy kind of fun name to say. And that's so obviously I had to think of how I was going to cry. And that just somehow came.
The Bunny Hop is one of the records in the movie.
That's like the Squares bolero.
Were you ever, you know, in my family at weddings and bar mitzvahs and things like that, back in the old days, there'd always be a bunny hop.
Oh, I had to do it too.
Really? This was the time to, like, go to the ladies' room and hide.
Well, at least it was easy to do, but it was just the problem with the bunny hop is you hop up and then back and then three times forward, so it takes an hour to go a foot. That was what I always hated about it. It was just such slow going to get to the other side of the room. But it's a very obnoxious dance, I think. And they kept saying, well, we should put it on the record album. I said, are you kidding? It can't be. It would drive people crazy to listen to that. No matter if it was first, last, where you placed it on the CD, it would make people take it off.
So it's not on there?
No.
Oh.
Well, every song is not anyway. But, I mean, it would have been torture. It's like the Squares bolero.
So what were the occasions when you had to do the bunny hop?
At dancing class that I had to go to, which was certainly this cotillion thing, which in my mind was worse than like going to the worst McMartin school if everything was true. And I don't know, certainly the RSVP charm school is based on that.
No kidding. So not only weren't you a drape, but you had to go to this charm school type of place.
Yes, which is just like charm school, actually, they would never use that word because
it's
really
for boys.
Trash went to charm school. But this was, certainly I went to a cotillion kind of place that was exactly like the one that's in this.
So what else did you learn there?
I learned how to want to be a juvenile delinquent. I learned, I discovered rage for the first time. That's what I learned. Fantasies of murdering all the people that ran it.
What did they think they were teaching you?
How to be a gentleman, which, believe me, I think I know how to act like a gentleman, but I didn't learn it there. I had fantasies there of whipping out a submachine gun, being like Charles Whitman does the waltz, is basically my fantasies. And, you know, I said this in an interview, and the woman who ran this place wrote a letter to Baltimore Magazine last month and saying, I remember him as a lovely, shy young man, and if I can take any credit even from his misery, I will. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, gosh. Did you have to dress up to go to the school?
Yes, you had to go there. And the worst was they taught you their version of the jitterbug, which was so square that you would be so mortified if anybody ever saw you doing it. Everybody hated it.
Now you could look back at this and laugh, right? But did you go?
No, I can't laugh. I want to shed a single tear. I could start sobbing and call a psychiatrist.
Was there ever a period in your life when you tried to cover this up and pretend like it never happened, didn't let anybody
know? It wasn't. Well, I just remember it as being something. I learned how to hook it, and eventually my parents would drop me off, and I'd go to the movies downtown. At least I got to go downtown from it. But, no, I remember just dreading it. That and Sunday school were the two things that I just thought, oh, God, now this. I mean, it certainly created a rebellion in me. So I guess I should be very thankful for it. And I've certainly used it, my memories of it, and exaggerated and fantasized them and fictionalized them into a movie. So that's what I'm saying. All your bad experiences are character building.
Hey, I'll keep that in mind. John Waters, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
John Waters wrote and directed the new film, Crybaby. This is Fresh Air.